Welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Lurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. Before I start, I would like to thank my two colleagues, Professors Rod Gillette and Roger Gafke, for conducting this program with such grace, style, and knowledge while I was out of the country last month. Terrorism is a worldwide threat that has not abated for a year. Palestinian killers continue to murder innocent Israelis, and Israel fights back. India and Pakistan face the prospect of a nuclear war. There is grim news the world over, but what dominates front pages in almost every country this week is the World Cup soccer tournament. It even upstaged the 50th anniversary jubilee of Queen Elizabeth II in England. Two underdogs helped to make it a story. One was Senegal, the African country that upset the world champions, the French team, last week, and the other was the United States, which finished last among 32 teams in the tournament 4 years ago and upset fifth-ranked Portugal yesterday. What is it that makes soccer such a big sport around the world, but not in the United States? To help us understand, we have two guests. In Buenos Aires, Argentina, Adrián Paenza, producer and host of the program Periodista for American TV. And in Cochin, India, T.R. Gopalakrishnan, editor of The Week. T.R., let's start with you. India doesn't have such a good soccer team, and yet World Cup football is a big, big story in your country. Why is that?
Thanks to television greatly. World Cup football first came into Indian living rooms in 1986, way back in the early 80s when Doordarshan started broadcasting it live. And subsequently, satellite channels have been bringing European and Latin American football live too. Football is popular here, though the standards are nowhere near Europe or Latin America. And the opportunity to watch world-class teams and world-class players generates a tremendous amount of interest. In fact, with this World Cup, till the last minute, I wasn't sure whether we would be able to get live TV. A lot of public pressure forced the company concerned to ensure that we do get a live telecast into in most of the cities in India too. The attraction is the world-class players and the world-class teams, which otherwise we would never get to see.
Adrián, in your country, there are now stories about how poor the economy is. But my guess is that all that is being upstaged by World Cup coverage right now. Is that right?
Well, maybe some people think that they can do that, but the problem is that people are starving in Argentina, and the new figures that we got, officially, they claim that 50% of the population is under the line of poverty, and we are talking about 19 million people, and the rate of unemployment officially accepted is close to 26%, and actually we could say, and without risking mistakes, that probably it's around 50%. So one out of two people are not working. So there's nothing, not even the World Cup, that could distract the population here. I mean, when Argentina plays, when the best games are played, naturally, for 2 hours, people are going to be glued to their TV sets. But other than that, I don't think so. Plus, let me add to the equation that the games are played at 3:30 in the morning, 4:30 in the morning, 5:30. So that's very tough for us, even for people that are working or are not working, because you have to keep going with your normal lives. People cannot stay because it's too late to be late, 3:30 in the morning, and it's too early to be early. I don't know if you follow what I'm trying to say.
I certainly follow you, and what is happening in Argentina is certainly very, very sad. And it is interesting to note that the sport does not overtake concern for the terrible economic situation that you have in your country.
Stuart, for political reasons, many, many times, I would say that always in our history, and probably this is not only a privilege of Argentina, most of the governments have tried to use sports to their benefit. And when there was a win, and Argentina has won a lot soccer-wise, most of the governments of all or all of them try to take credit for that. But in this time, I don't think so. Even if Argentina gets it all the way and wins the tournament, which I don't know, we are candidate, Argentina is a candidate, but I don't know if they will do it. I don't think that the president or the government can take credit for nothing at this point in time. So I don't think this is the case. Could have been, but the situation is so tough here. The country is falling apart. We changed five presidents in almost 15 days. So there's no World Cup, no soccer, no nothing that could distract at this point in time the situation of the people.
Mm-hmm. Presidents seem to take an interest in World Cup soccer throughout the world. The other day, President Putin in Russia saw the Russian soccer team off. And he said to the coach, we are waiting for you to win. And he said that rather threateningly, as if to say that coach is going to lose his job if Russia does not do better than it has done in the last couple of years, or last couple of World Cups, I should say. What is it that makes football, world football, soccer, such an interesting game around the world, and why is it not taken so seriously in the United States? Do either of you have any thoughts about that? Explain what it is that makes it such a good game to the American radio audience.
I don't know if PR wants to throw his thoughts first, but you tell me.
Go ahead, Adrian.
No,
you go
no,
first.
Please go ahead, Mr. Adrian.
Thank you. Well, I don't know if I have a special reason, but I've been putting some thought to it because I go to the U.S. quite a bit. And what I've thought is that most of the American sports are played with their hands. I mean, baseball, basketball. Even hockey, you need, I mean, you're skating, but you have to have some skills, let alone football, your own football. On the other hand, in the rest of the world, when you throw a ball to a kid, instead of grabbing it with the hand, even if you throw it to their chest, most of the kids are not allowed to catch the ball with their hands. They have to use the rest of the body to show that they have a certain skill level. So, I mean, it's very, I don't know if this is the reason, because it's so simple to be considered one of the reasons, at least, but I don't think it's a one-dimensional thing. But the Americans have the tendency, the kids that I've observed, to play their sports with their hands. Why? I don't know. But in the rest of the world, I mean, most of the kids that I've seen, and I've flown all over the countries and all over the continents, most of the kids like to play with their feet. That's what I found as the big difference for me. Now, does it explain the whole thing? I don't think so. But at least it gives you an opportunity to think about something.
Mm-hmm. TR, what do you think? Is it a hands versus feet situation?
No, I really wouldn't know. I'm surprised that football hasn't caught on in America. Maybe it's because there hasn't been too much of a tradition. But I think football's appeal worldwide is largely one because it's not a very expensive game to play. It doesn't require too much equipment in that sense, and it's very easy to watch and enjoy. Secondly, a lot of the, let's say, stars of football, there have been so many kind of rags-to-riches stories in football history of people from poor families becoming stars, becoming rich. I think in many countries that's also a major attraction, especially in a country like India, say, where sports is one way of moving up the income ladder. I guess one must give credit to FIFA, who have marketed the game so well over the last 50 to 60 years. In today's world, I think marketing plays such a big role. But certainly the star value and the star quality that footballers from Latin America, there's so many names one can take from Argentina, from Brazil, from England, from Germany, who are stars in their own right. I mean, as big as any film star, which does lend attraction to the game.
Yeah. I hate to sound cynical about this, but one of the things that occurs to me is that soccer is a game that once you start it, you don't stop it except for a halftime recess. But in American sports, football, basketball, baseball, there are pauses throughout the game during which television can show commercials. So it occurs to me that maybe television in this country does not encourage the development of football in the same way that it encourages the development of other sports. Do you see anything to that?
Yeah, but in any event, if that was the case, which it's not that I disagree, but television was not around 50 years ago, and soccer was it was big, very big. The World Cups are being held like starting in the 30s, 1930, 1934, 38. Even Hitler tried to take advantage of that. So, I mean, and television was not even a consideration. And in England, in Hungary, in Italy, in Europe, all over Europe, it was a big, big game. And also in Latin America, especially in Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay, to name just the three top teams in South America. So that could be the case now, and I would agree with you, because they have been trying to insert some kind of timeouts and things like that while they televised the games. But 30, 40 years ago, would you still think that that was the case?
Well, of course, 30 or 40 years ago, it was not the case. And maybe at that time, it was just a matter of American isolation from the rest of the world. American sports, baseball in particular, and to some extent basketball, I think is pretty much an American game that has spread around the world. But American sports have followed, in a lot of cases, the American military to Japan, to Korea, and a little bit less to Europe. But I think that might be part of it also. Just as TR was telling me that in India, really the big games are field hockey and cricket, so that football hasn't really caught on in the same way in India, the second largest country in the world, as it has in other countries around the world.
Yeah, that's true, but football has a major TV audience in India. I mean, if you look at the World Cup currently being telecast in virtually throughout the country. I mean, you're talking of potential audiences of 30 million, 40 million viewers for each of the telecasts, which is a huge audience. And these are names, teams and players who are fairly familiar here thanks to cable, satellite television, and people are, and at least the urban audience has been seeing them. Take somebody like Beckham in England, the English player. He's, I think, known as much in urban India as he is in England or elsewhere. Pele, Maradona. You know, these are names which are just as familiar to the Indian who may not play football at all. I mean, the Indian team is nowhere, but if you were to talk to an average person in the street in Cochin, for instance, I'm sure he can rattle off the top players of most of the teams currently taking part in. Kerala in particular, football is a big, big game. And some of the places in Kerala, if you were to see the kind of audience for these matches, you'd be quite surprised. And definitely one hopes that bringing this telecast to India would also help raise the standard of football within the country. But the star value of footballers, I think, should be conceded. I think that's a very big factor that does attract people to football.
Okay, we have to take a break now. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist on KBIA. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or here in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 573-882-9641. We have talked a lot about football, and yet, as Adrian Paenza pointed out, there are other stories of great importance around the world, and two of them are in your countries. We had hoped to have a journalist from Pakistan on the line with us, but unfortunately we have had some communications difficulties today. T.R. Gopalakrishnan, tell us, what is the prospect for war between Pakistan and India right now? Is there still that danger, or do you think that war will be avoided over the Kashmir situation?
Mr. Lurie, as a journalist in India, I have always felt that there was absolutely no possibility of a war even 10 days or 2 weeks back. This was a lot of rhetoric, and I can say with great confidence that there will be no war at all. I mean, this was, I guess, a diplomatic ploy from both sides to get the attention of the world, raising of rhetoric, saying a lot of things. But war was never on the cards. I think governments, especially the Indian government, knows the cost and would definitely not would not consider such a option at this time. But I think the kind of rhetoric and the pitch that was raised after the massacre of the families of army men by militants is part of diplomacy these days. I mean, and it definitely got the attention of the world. So war was never a serious possibility.
Okay. Adrian, you just heard TR say that there was never any danger of war between India and Pakistan. Was the story being covered as a war scare in Argentina the same way it was here in the United States?
Yes, it definitely was. And it was in the front cover of the major newspaper for every day, although we have our own local problems, which are very, very deep. But we cannot forget, and in that respect, Argentina, it's not that most places, even in the U.S., we really care about what's happening, not only in the U.S., but in the rest of the world. And the potential war, even becoming a potential nuclear war, is very threatening. So we were really very concerned. Now, because TR says that there was never a consideration of a war, and what I would ask, and ask myself, and I would ask you too, why and who was interested in letting us know and that there could be a war when there couldn't be one. So, I mean, I'm trying to figure out who is the benefiting of saying that there could be something that cannot be.
TR, what is your comment on that? I think it's a terrific question. Here are two nuclear powers. As Adrian points out, they're facing off with the possibility that there could actually be nuclear weapons used. Who is benefiting from all of this war talk if there is no chance of war?
I don't know. I don't think the Indian government or anyone from India talked of war. I mean, the Indian government was only talking of retaliating against known terrorists who attacked civilians and killed women and children.
They're still talking of that.
Because it's still happening. Yesterday there was an attack on a bus in Kashmir, civilians were killed. Now, this is something which India has been saying for a long time, that, you know, this is happening with the connivance of the Pakistani government and certain agencies of the government, which I think India has been trying to convey to the world. We have been saying it for many, many months. After September 11th, we thought we were getting a sympathetic ear. But the three consecutive attacks, attack on the Kashmir parliament, the attack on the Indian parliament, and this last, I think, a very cowardly attack on the families of army men by suicide bombers belonging to various militant and terrorist groups based in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir led to a heightened rhetoric. There's a lot of public sentiment in India, you know, which we did an opinion poll as a magazine across about nine cities, and you'd be surprised. I was surprised that the average person in the street is so angry that he says that, yes, let's go to war, that we should retaliate against Pakistan in some way. So that there's definitely a buildup of public opinion, and I guess the government thought they could take advantage of that. I don't think you should be looking at who gains or who loses, but certainly if it wasn't for the war talk, I doubt whether America would be sending such high-level diplomatic representatives to this part of the world and forcing the Pakistani president to take note of the fact that POK is harboring terrorists and that they are the ones who are arming them and who are allowing them to come into India. So we've had, Ms. Roca's visit earlier. Now Richard Armitage is arriving here tomorrow. Mr. Donald Rumsfeld is arriving on Monday, I think June 10th. Certainly, India's constant refrain that, you know, the world should take note that we are victims of terrorism as much as America was in September 11 has definitely gone home. War rhetoric is, I think, part of diplomacy in a time like this. It happened in December 13th after the attack on Parliament. But mobilization took place. I think that's standard precaution. But the Indian government, I think, has always been very responsible in its statements. Over to you.
Adrian, what do you think about what TR just said? Is that satisfactory?
Well, you know what? I mean, it's very tough for me to have an opinion. It would be very unprofessional that I throw my opinion on that one, because I don't know. I mean, I was just posing the question because we are too far and I don't know the players here. The thing is that if there was never a concern of a nuclear war, I would, and as TR says that India has never been involved in nothing like that, I would expect that the government, both of them, like the Pakistanis and the Indians, would have come out and said, listen, no matter what happens, we have a problem. We have to decide what we're going to do with this, the situation that we have in this area of the world, but there's no way that we are going to be involved in a nuclear situation. And that has been said emphatically to the rest of the world, then at least you know that there is a problem and it has to be solved, but no with a war or with a nuclear war, which is very concerning with anybody or everybody.
May I respond to that, Mr. Lurie?
Please.
I think the bogey of a nuclear war was not raised from the Indian side. The Indian government, right at the time of the test, has as a matter of policy, made it clear that there is no first use. It was the Pakistani ambassador to the United Nations who said that, you know, we reserve the right to use it. India has consistently said that we would never use nuclear weapons, and Indian media has, I think, we are a democracy and a free press, and the Indian media has been highlighting constantly the dangers involved in any kind of escalation. I mean, even if it's just a small skirmish on the border.
Yeah, but TR, India was the first of the two countries to develop nuclear weapons. If India is not going to use nuclear weapons, why did it bother to develop them?
Mr. Lurie, why did any country bother to develop it? Why did China? Why did Britain? Why did France? And in India's case, we already had one nuclear neighbor, which is China, a known nuclear power. So it is understood in strategic thing that a nuclear power is a major deterrent. Somehow it seems to be that the world takes better notice of you if you have a nuclear bomb rather than if you don't. After all, it's not a capability that was sudden. I mean, ever since Mrs. Gandhi made the first blast in 1974, the potential was always there. For over 25 years, India did not go down that line, but I think the continuous provocations across the border and the fact that, you know, we have a nuclear armed neighbor that forced Indian strategic thinkers to go down that line. But the Indian government has been very categorical on this point. I think the triggering point was the Pakistan ambassador to the UN, who made a very categorical statement. He said, we reserve the right to use it. For the UN ambassador of Pakistan to say that, I think, I don't know whether they actually intended to use it or just to frighten everybody. But as a journalist and as an observer here and reading the papers and a lot of strategic, serious defense writers in the Indian media, we were quite sure that, you know, it will not go beyond anything further. We knew that this was more of diplomatic rhetoric. But yes, I think the Pakistan in reserving the right to first use of nuclear weapons does cause a problem. I mean, I don't think India is causing the problem.
Okay. I think we are all heartened by what you said about the prospect of war not being very great. I would like to change the subject and go to Argentina now. Adrian, yes. The United States has been very involved in military activities around the world, and yet we read stories that say the United States has not been very involved in Argentina, and to the extent that it has been, it has bungled its job. What do you think? Is it necessary for the United States to take more action to help bail out the Argentinian economy or improve it?
Well, first of all, I would, if you allow me to say it, I would strongly dispute that the United States have not been involved in Argentinian economy. I would say that the IMF, the World Bank, and you can name as many organizations as it's too big that I just named, have been deeply involved in Argentina. I mean, there has, even now, there is such an involvement of the IMF that Argentina is changing its legislation, and the people are really mad because the Congress people are changing our laws because the IMF just blatantly wrote that we need to change two laws. And we did, which is absolutely incredible. I mean, it's just incredible. The IMF, and I showed in my TV show, we showed the not even a private document, almost it was official document from the IMF that said, in order for us to help you guys, what you need to do is this and this and this. This is what you have to do with your provinces. This is what the governors have to sign. This is what changes have to be made to your laws. So, again, now, can we say that the U.S. or the IMF or the World Bank were not involved? No. I think that actually our some of our problems are, necessarily most of our problems are because of us, of the corruption that is in almost every level in the political arena here. That is big, big, very big, and I don't want to put the blame somewhere else. But say that the U.S. or the IMF or the World Bank were not involved, that's not true.
To the extent that the IMF and the World Bank were involved, its policies helped to create some of the problem. Is that true? Just take a couple of seconds.
Exactly. That's exactly what I tried to pass that message. Yeah.
Okay.
That is the case.
Right. I'm sorry, but we are out of time. Our guests today have been in Buenos Aires, Argentina, Adrian Paenza, and in Cochin, India, T.R. Gopalakrishnan. Our director is Pat Akers, and our producer, Mariana De Mayo. For all, I'm Stuart Laurie, global journalist. We'll be back next week.